Hey listeners, welcome to this year's first episode of The Plant. Thanks for clicking play. If you're a loyal subscriber, we can't thank you enough. For any first timers, The Plant is focused on exploring the ins and outs of industrial automation. We're now wrapping up our series on digital transformation that we started last year. Today, we're taking a little pivot from software and talking about the hardware, panels, PCs, and thin clients that make manufacturing and industrial processes what they are in the digital transformation and today's modern industrial space. Tom and I got a chance to talk with Al Letourneau and Michael Moriarty, two managers, aka hardware pros from Rockwell Automation. The combination of knowledge between these two covers over 50 years of tech. Mike and Al share some insight about not only where they started, but also maybe where they're going when talking hardware and the digital age. I hope you enjoy this episode as much as we did. Don't forget to subscribe, and if you have a chance, share this episode with a friend or colleague. Tom, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Brian, how are you?
Man, I am doing pretty good, and I'm excited for this episode. And we talked about before we started recording that, you know, we took a break. We took kind of the end of the year off. Yep. And the first month of the year, and it's been kind of a crazy busy time, I think, for everybody, but it's good to be back.
It is great to be back, and you're right, the world is changing rapidly, but that's okay. You know, we're in the automation business, so we're here to help with that.
Yeah. Yeah. Which never stops changing.
Never.
Just maybe not always super fast, but actually that kind of leads us into this show. This is our last episode in our mini series about digital transformation, and what we thought would be really cool, and the guests that we actually have two guests coming on, but what's really cool is that we are going to talk about the hardware. And I think everything has been about software visualization. It's all been about, you know, data and the transformation from a digital outlook. And so I think it's kind of cool to get to talk about the hardware.
Totally agree. And just for our listeners' reference, when we say hardware today, we're typically talking like human machine interface type hardware, right? We realize that hardware, if you say the word hardware, could cover sensors and everything. But really today, what we're talking about would be like display terminals, interface software, industrial PCs, right? That kind of thing. And just so our customers know, you know, one of the things you're going to hear today is we do reference software-defined architecture, and that's a term that's being thrown around a lot lately. And so hardware kind of gets left in the cold a lot these days because software is such a hot topic. But just for, our listeners' reference, GrandviewResearch.com has some numbers out there that they've published recently that show the growth in the human machine interface market from 2020 rather to 2030. They're predicting a over 10% annual growth every year in that market. And that's across display terminals, interface software, and industrial PC. So we may think software is leading the charge, but the growth in the hardware market is still fantastic and quite lucrative.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, and it's year over year, so 10%,
that's 10%, right.
You know, and I think that's kind of incredible. I think a lot of people think about, you know, even from the consumer space, you're holding, you know, your smartphone, and you may think about all the apps and everything, but of course, without the device, you got nothing.
So, that's right.
Well, let me tell you a little bit about, we've lined up two people, and I think what's really cool is they work together. They both work for Rockwell, but Al Letourneau and Mike Moriarty are two guests. But Al has been, I think he's been in the industry for over 40 years. He's been dealing with hardware kind of since before there was all the HMIs and before there was, you know, the ability to, I guess, incorporate so much software, so much connectivity. And so he's really just, I mean, you say some people are a fountain of information. He's like a mountain of information. I mean,
he's
been doing it for a long time. So I'm really excited to have him on and be able to talk about that. And then Mike is, I think he's been doing it for over a decade. He's done a lot of panel stuff, a lot of visualization hardware. And so obviously knows knows tons on his own.
That's right. And he must be a very brave man stepping in to fill Al Paterno's shoes.
Yeah, right. And then before we bring them on, I actually did look up an interesting fact since we are talking about hardware that I thought would be kind of cool to talk about. And that is that in this month, in 1952, the very first don't walk and walk signs, automatic walk and don't walk signs, were installed and invented in New York City, and now are used all over the world.
Fantastic.
And it's all, you know, timers and connections to the lights. And but yeah, 1952.
Absolutely. So traffic control systems for people. Yeah.
73 years ago.
Wow. And here we are. Like you said, it's all still automated, right?
Yeah.
We haven't changed that system yet.
No. And I know that's slightly different in other countries, but I think the mechanics and the theory behind it is exactly the same.
Absolutely.
So, all right. Well, let me see if I can get everybody on the line. I think this is the first time we've had two guests at the same time.
It is. Looking forward to that.
Yeah. Also, let me see what I can do.
Let's do it.
All right, hold on. Guys, how are you doing?
Marvelous.
Yes.
Yeah, doing well.
Well, I can't thank you guys enough for agreeing to come on here. And I know we talked about it before last week when we talked, but, you know, Tom and I have been doing episodes really about digital transformation. And every single episode we've done has been about software and kind of how, you know, the digital age has changed. And it's been about the data that we get through data or through like data mosaics. And, you know, we talked about Emulate 3D and we've talked about HMIs and visualization. And so I'm excited to have you guys on here because hardware and Al, I know, you've been doing this for a long time. So we've got both of you on here. Why don't we just quickly, like, Al, tell us a little bit about yourself, how long you've been in automation, and then we can move on to Mike.
My name is Al Paterno. I work in the visualization and computing platforms business, and I'm a product manager. And I've worked for Rockwell now for 41 years. Started off in service, then I went to sales, did some commercial marketing, done some system ownership type things within the company, did commercial terms for corporate agreements, and then came to work in the business unit where I've been for the last 4 or 5 years. And I've worked with our visualization products pretty much off and on throughout that time. I've worked with visualization products going all the way back to before PCs were invented. Throughout the PC era, I worked with most of the applications that we have sold that run on Windows platforms. And worked a little bit with optics, which is a relatively new piece of software. Also worked with the various hardware devices, too. So I've got pretty long tenure with the company and pretty long history with these various visualization products.
That's really cool. You might actually be the first person we've had on here who, you know, worked with the company before PCs had anything to do with visualization and all that kind of stuff. I mean, what was visualization before it was computerized?
Well, we invented some purpose-built platforms with some early operating systems. Like there was a product that we had that was all based on firmware-driven memory where you had to actually have little UV prompt chips that you'd burn and you'd erase them in a little tiny tanning bed. 7 1/4-inch floppies. It ran an operating system called CPM, which predated DOS. And, yeah, they cost like $25,000.
Wow.
So, yeah. And communicated on a baseband network at a screaming 57.6 thousand bits per minute. So, they were on a multi-drop network. They could see multiple controllers. After that, we started to introduce products that, again, were hardware, firmware-based appliance-type products. But they would literally have, like, physical push buttons on them, and they would connect on multi-drop networks where the controller was in the middle of it. They couldn't see the broader peer-to-peer network. So it was just kind of like a push-button replacement scenario.
Yeah.
And needless to say, since they couldn't get to the broader network and they couldn't see any of the other controllers or computers, they were kind of a dead end in terms of data flow.
Wow, Al, you have been doing this quite a long time. So Michael, give us a little bit of your history. How long have you been in automation and what is your work experience with Rockwell?
Yeah. So my experience is, of course, a lot less than Al's.
I started with at Rockwell in 2015, and I actually started on the development as a project manager, working on the PanelView 5000 series as a project manager. And that was when we were launching the PanelView 5510 and the 5310. So the PanelView 5000 is, of course, it's our HMI product that's purpose-built to work with Compact Logics and have deep integration with our Compact Logics controllers. And actually, right at the end of that project, before we launched it, I moved into a product manager role and was actually assigned the same exact products that I was working on developing. So I got to experience the whole cycle and launch those products into the market at the end of the product. And you know, support the launch and support them in the field. I've been a product manager for that product, as well as more recently Optics Panel, which is our newest HMI product for FactoryTalk Optics. And just in the last couple of weeks here, I've moved into a commercial portfolio manager role that actually Al was previously doing up until a few weeks ago.
Fantastic. Well, Brian, it sounds like we got the right two people have a hardware discussion about digital transformation.
Well, I think what's so cool is, you know, the last decade, even since Mike came on with the company, I mean, I think a lot has changed. A lot's progressed. Things have gotten smaller and faster. And, you know, you mentioned optics. That's a big one in the optics panel coming out. And, you know, I guess when we talk about digital transformation, it's fun to hear Al talk about, you know, really the entire transformation, the birth and transformation of digital in a lot of ways. But, I guess one of the reasons I wanted to have this conversation in general is to get, you know, kind of where it's gone, where we see it going. And as we've gotten into more modern technology with cloud and data and edge and all the things, kind of how that's played into y'all's positions and jobs. And either one of you can go first, because that was a very broad thing to throw out there. But, you know, maybe whoever wants to jump in, you know, and kind of talk about kind of your experience over time with the hardware and how it's changed, I guess.
Well, I'll jump in first, I guess. Again, if I go back to the real early days that I was talking about, I think it was required that in order for these products to really generate any value, you had to have the controller in the same place as the HMI type hardware and software in the same place as the person. You literally had a controller with a wire running through a conduit to a operator interface product of some kind or other, be it a PC or some other more lower end product. And the human being had to stand there and look at the embedded screen and punch buttons on it and stuff. I mean, it was, the whole thing was pretty much geographically determined that way. And as the devices got more sophisticated and as they started to be able to furnish data, not only in terms of like VNC, for example, or furnish it in terms of web sessions that you could stream to a browser, you started to decouple the physical location of the device and the data source from the user of the data. You started to be able to see data flowing out of control elements like a Compact Logics or Control Logics. It would be just gathered up through one or more HMIs displayed on the embedded screen, logged to a database, either on the local device or potentially to some remote server, even pushed up into the cloud now with the Optics Panel, where you can actually do MQTT, collect data from multiple, not just multiple controllers, but multiple brands of controllers using purpose-built protocol drivers, and then push it all the way up to the cloud. So you see a case where there's no longer any kind of physical constraint on where you collect the data from, what you do with it, at what level. You could process it at the edge, push it up to the cloud, visualize it through different applications that might be local to the processor elsewhere in the world. So there's, you really get the option of really implementing this architecture in terms of the geography of it, however it makes sense.
Fantastic. So Al, back in the early description you were given a moment ago, of the controller being connected directly to this visualization device or whatever. What actually came first back in the day, hardware or software? Did we have a piece of hardware that needed some sort of software in order to advance its use? Or was someone writing code saying, hey, you know what, I think I could apply this to make switches and whatnot, do other things to make hardware more useful? What actually came first, chicken or the egg?
Well, hardware came along first, because at that time, there was really no such thing as software if you go back far enough. I mean, if you go back a little bit before I joined the company, they had controllers that were all driven by core memory, like physical little magnetic donuts flipping back and forth.
Right.
Yeah. And this is like mid-70s, let's say. And then as the hardware, the control elements started to advance, then they started to see these firmware-based terminals that you used to control them or used to program them. At that point, there was still no such thing as an operator interface. They would still just connect up big button boards. So you'd have individual buttons connected to physical input. So at that point, there was really – the hardware consisted of a bunch of push buttons, and there was no software. But as we started to move in, like at the time I joined, like I said, they started to invent products that had screens on them, and those had then – an operating system, although it was a crude one. They had software, although it was all 8-bit, you know, 256 color software, and really crude programming languages, statement-oriented sure. programming languages that were assembled into machine code and run on a bad operating system, CPM, as I mentioned. So once we started to have things with screens, you needed software.
So essentially, software. And correct me if I'm wrong here, but essentially software, particularly in the early days, was just an abstract way of replacing what would have been a hardware interaction. Is that correct?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. And in fact, inside the controllers, the programming language they invented at the time, which they still use, is what's called ladder logic that looks like physical wiring.
It actually looks like the wiring itself. So that's what I want our listeners to understand, is that software is like any other invention, right? It's a necessity that brought it along. Hardware was getting more and more complex. There were more and more buttons, push buttons, and alternative ways of using the hardware, as you were describing. And software allows us to abstract some of that hardware layer and push it around and move it. And as you said, the geolocation becomes wider at that point. The connectivity options become broader at that point. So here we are in this modern world now, and we've come so far now that I think that most people don't even understand that software is simply still an abstraction of something we want the hardware to do. And so really hardware is the business, even though we live in what the world would say software defined architecture. I think I've heard that term thrown around a lot these days. How does hardware live in an environment that is defined by software?
Well, what you mean by software-defined architecture, that could mean a few different things, but I'll just address a couple of the more likely definitions of what that would mean. As we started to see more PCs used in industrial automation systems, initially, people on the plant floor, what we now call OT people, would get some PCs and they'd set them up. And in some cases, their relationship with IT was so strained that they would literally hide them. They would put them in cabinets where the IT people didn't know they were there. They didn't have a networking strategy where the IT people could see them on the network. They'd build their own networks. They'd hide them in boxes and try to run them and do what they needed to do. And that was a software-defined architecture of sorts. But as tools like Thin Manager came along, and as we started to have better kind of junction points for IT and OT to work together, their relationships became a lot less strained. And so a software-defined architecture could be a bunch of PCs on a network. In that case, in the olden days, if one of those PCs, well, first of all, you had to install all the applications and all the data and do all the horsing around on the individual PCs. As we started to see tools like Thin Manager deployed, you started to see the PCs being syndicated of content from the Thin server. And so if a PC died, you could replace it readily. Also, the PCs got cheaper and smaller because they weren't doing as much of the heavy lifting at the level of the individual PC. So that's clearly an architecture, and it's clearly software defined. And it's almost all PCs, although you can have other things on there too, like panel view terminals that were doing VNC streaming or doing web sessions streaming over the Thin Manager network. So that's a software defined architecture. I think the buzzword that you hear kicked around a lot within Rockwell these days, the SDA or software defined architecture, what that refers to is actually using PCs to replace real time control elements like a Compact Logix or Control Logix.
Okay. Okay.
And
now we're getting some.
In that case, those will be PC hardware, more or less, but they won't be running Windows or Linux or any of the things that we typically run, or Thin Manager for that matter, that we typically would run an HMI package on. They'll be running a real-time operating system that has deterministic response, because doing life safety critical systems like a roller coaster or something like that, you need to know exactly how long it's going to take to scan the program, and you need to have predictable failure mode behavior and stuff. And you only get that with a real-time operating system. Windows and Linux won't do that. So the SDA that you might have heard about, like at Automation Fair, which we showed industrial PC running the Logix engine, that's not running Windows. It's a PC in name only. It's PC hardware, but the operating system doesn't look like anything that you'd see in the consumer space.
Now, that's very interesting. What's the benefit of architecting something that way versus just using a traditional controller?
Gives people more deployment options. It could drive out some cost. You could virtualize them, so you have multiple controllers running on a single box. I mean, it's sort of like what we've done with optics, where with optics you can deploy it to one or more PCs. You can deploy it to an appliance that's basically a little terminal with a screen on the front. You can deploy it to a module that hangs on the wall that has no display. You can deploy it to a module that fits right into the controller chassis. So it's sort of analogous to that, whereas in the control space, the real-time control space, we typically have deployed it only to purpose-built hardware, firmware-based modular controllers.
This is fascinating.
Yeah, no, it really is. I mean, and it kind of gives you, I don't know, an idea of how much option there is now with configuration, deployment, really how you can set things up. And it's interesting that you talk about like the roller coasters and, you know, how you really have to be able to react and scan and read and predict so quickly that makes perfect sense. And I think, or at least I'm assuming that, you know, as all of this has grown and changed, that different places around the world are so much better connected, and something that can be virtualized like that and can be, duplicated and cloned and fine tuned, probably, you know, has amazing benefits to it, you know, for the end user.
So maybe a question for Mike here. How has all these changes in the hardware world, how has that affected the role of the operator? Is the operator the same kind of person they were 30 years ago, or is the operator of today different based on the kind of hardware?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think a lot of cases, if you have to answer that, you kind of have to look at the whole deployment chain of how these get to an end user. I think that there's probably more stops along the way in terms of, you're deploying a more complex solution into a plant or to run a factory. So there's, I think, a lot more architecting that's required. I think there's a higher degree of IT involvement in terms of setting things up on networks, making them secure, deploying and managing, the software and what goes out to what target device out on the plant floor and how that's managed. And then the day to day, I think there's a lot of efficiency gains in being able to centrally manage a lot of the overhead and upkeep and maintenance of the applications and the ongoing maintenance that might be related to keeping things secured. If there's any updates that need to be pushed, you can. I think there's a lot of advantages to be able to centrally do that as well. But at the end of the day, I think to the very end person that's interfacing with the hardware themselves, hopefully they have a better experience in terms of something that's nice to look at, a responsive piece of hardware, and and something that helps them do their job. But at the end of the day, at the very end person, it's very similar. So I think a lot of the differences are in the in-between, in the deployment and management side.
It sounds like the modern systems are designed for the modern worker versus the modern worker designing the system.
Yes, exactly.
Got it.
One of the things that I wanted to ask you guys about is kind of a future look at hardware, and especially as we get into, you know, VR, augmented reality, all this kind of stuff. Do you think, and maybe this is a good question for Mike, because you've worked so much with the panel views. I mean, do you ever think that, you know, that could become augmented with a set of glasses, or even virtual, where maybe somebody's not standing in front of a panel, but they're wearing, you know, the device that gives them that panel?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really interesting concept. I mean, it's been actually a couple of years now, but at one point we were looking into some augmented reality opportunities and kind of trying to figure out how we could leverage some of that technology. We found many of the use cases especially valuable to things like maintenance personnel and things like that. Operators could bring up manuals virtually next to the machine and look at things. And, you know, with augmented reality, you have call outs right on the machine instead of having to reference an actual PDF or some other document. So there's a lot of interesting advantages. So we think someday, but as we looked into the technology and where things were, we're not quite there yet. So I think it's something that's probably further out on the horizon, in terms of being a reality.
Yeah. Out of curiosity, you know, and maybe Al, you're a good one to answer this, over time, you know, are people, especially in an industry that maybe changes a little slower, like automation or industrial manufacturing, do you think people are a little hesitant to adopt a new way of doing things? And has that, like, ever been a struggle as the technology progresses to get people to maybe change their habits or you know, adopt a new idea?
Well, I think people are pretty careful and want to be pretty judicious about how they evolve their operations because they need to keep the risk manageable. I mean, there are industries like papermaking, for example, where they make all their money in the final day of the year. The margins are so thin that downtime is just poison. Downtime will sink them as a company. They just need to be extremely careful that they don't put their uptime at risk. So that's an extreme example, but I think in general, not only is security, it's a consideration where they need to make sure they keep everything at a high level of information security. They need to make sure that they keep everything really, really safe for their users, because a lot of these operations can be somewhat dangerous. So we have safety systems and stuff now embedded in the actual controllers and the network devices and so on. So yeah, people are very, very careful about that. And I think that's entirely necessary. There's actually lots of standards, especially in Europe, for how these systems work and how the failure mode behavior has to be controlled and so on. So yeah, they're extremely careful. I'd say that Rockwell has really displayed a lot of leadership over the decades that I've worked for them in terms of advancing those standards and helping to move those things along in a way that's, I think, judicious and progressive, but not so let's say, rapid that it causes greater risk and really leaves the customers behind. I think it's kind of a delicate dance that we do with things like regulatory agencies, with customers, with our partners and so on, to advance that stuff at a appropriate rate of progress without increasing the risk. But yeah, people are careful and there's reasons for that. It's these industries, a lot of them are very capital intensive. They can't afford to do reinvestment and turn around their operations every year because they just cost so much. And again, they can't take things down. If you look at oil and gas, for example, they'll do turnarounds where they'll shut down a plant like every 5 years for a month and do everything they can in the time they got and then bring it back up because they can't afford to be down. The chemical industry is the same way. So yeah, they're really careful. They need the product life cycles to be really, really long. When we sell them stuff, they want to know if they can continue buying it for, you know, years to come. I mean, there's extreme examples, for example, with the military, where they need to be able to, they need to be sure they can buy stuff for like decades. So they'll forward buy stuff and put it on the shelf and so on. But yeah, it varies somewhat by industry, but there's extreme examples like that. And then there's people that are a lot more agile, and we can support both.
And Al, that you're describing, again, what separates industrial hardware from what people would consider commercial hardware, right? That we have to have these devices that last a long time, because that's the ask from the customer. That's actually the demand and the need from the customer. They wouldn't survive, as you stated, if they were trying to use commercial grade products to do the work that they do. And so that's why we develop the products that we do. So along that line, what are current trends that you see in hardware design and development, besides everything maybe getting smaller as we get into the future? What are some other trends? Is it trying to fit with all the regulations, as you mentioned earlier, or is it coming up with new materials to design and build the machines out of? What is the new trend or the latest trend?
Well, I'm going to back up and tag one thing onto the previous answer here. Just another somewhat extreme example of people who have to control the evolution of their processes, but it's a very important market segment for us, is life sciences. Because if you make pharmaceuticals or medical devices or implanted devices or what have you, those systems are validated by the FDA. And so they can't change anything in the system once it's been validated, or they got to revalidate it, which is unbelievably expensive. So that's a case where if you sell them a computer, for example, that has an operating system on it, that operating system can't change for a decade. So if you compare that to the consumer space, where you buy a new computer every 4 or 5 years because the other one gets too slow or breaks or whatever, the life sciences applications in particular have to be very careful how rapidly they evolve. So coming back to your question now about how we see hardware evolving in the future, of course, there's always the smaller, cheaper, faster thing. I think there's the distributed environment where you see less concentration of compute power in a single box, because those boxes end up being big and expensive and generate a lot of heat. End up seeing widely distributed networks of smaller, lower powered nodes, consistent with what you guys do with ThinManager, where you have, instead of having a box that's like the size of a shoebox you'd put cowboy boots into, the box is twice the size of an alphabet block. You get your failure modes managed by taking the thing off the wall and tossing it versus having to reinstall all the software. So I think what we're seeing is increase in compactness. The products get smaller. In some cases, they're so small, then they, given that they have high powered CPUs, they have heat sinks on them that look like something you'd see on the side of a lawnmower. I mean, so because they generate so much heat. But yeah, increasingly compact, increasingly powerful, and more broadly distributed, more nodes, smaller nodes, lower concentration.
Yeah. And again, this is kind of going back to the beginning, because the mainframe idea worked along those lines, except that the mainframe computer itself was a very large device. But the idea was that you'd have a centralized way to compute and send that out to nodes, if you will. And essentially, we're doing the same thing in the modern world, except that the size of that server is nowhere near what it used to be back in the mainframe days. As a matter of fact, a client can actually be a server or a client and a server these days. To your point, that the processing power can be put into such a compact unit now that we're almost starting to see, it from our perspective at ThinManager at least, a server and a client physically might not be different at all as we go forward into the future, as far as size and what they, you know, what it looks like. You wouldn't be able to just look at a box and go, oh, that's a server, or oh, that's a client. You would actually have to turn it on and find out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, less and less are people using the big racks, the old server racks and everything. I think a combination, it seems like the office utility needs are becoming more and more virtualized, and the floor itself, the servers are getting smaller. And yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, guys, I can't thank you enough for coming on here. Really, we won't take up too much more of your time. Honestly, this is exactly what I wanted to get out of this conversation, and I can't thank you guys enough.
Maybe one more question for Al. We had the fun question in here. Where was it? What's the most important hardware advancement you've seen in your long career, Al? And what is the least? And maybe just tell us the least. That may be more fun.
Well, I'd say the most important and the least important are actually the same thing.
Okay.
And it's artificial intelligence.
Ah.
I could tell you that if you go back to the late 80s, there were people talking about artificial intelligence back in the late 80s. And frankly, it was just a bunch of hype. It was nonsense, transparently so. And because back then, we didn't have the data sets. We didn't have the compute power. You know, it just was, it was a nice thought, but it was, as we say, purely aspirational.
Right.
Whereas now, you know, 40 years later, we're actually starting to see artificial intelligence make real contributions. We've embedded it in a bunch of our different products, both in terms of checking for penetrations, for example, for malware, checking for or helping people write code that would go into an optics system or into their real-time controllers or logic controllers. So, and that's just the beginning. I think artificial intelligence has a lot of potential for industrial automation.
Hardware using again, software to help hardware.
No, you're absolutely right. And I think artificial intelligence, I actually just had this conversation with my daughter yesterday because there's a big misunderstanding, especially and she's, you know, a young teenager. So take it for what it's worth. But when she talks about artificial intelligence, it's almost like she's confusing it with just about anything that has an algorithm to do something. You know, including like a cartoon version of a picture that she's like, oh, that's the new AI. And it's like, that's not what that is. And I think, you know, artificial intelligence, especially like you talked about from the ability to do starter code or kind of get something going, get a project moving quickly and then predict what might go wrong or steps that have gone wrong. Or when you look at predictive maintenance and things like that, I agree. There's a lot there that could be very exciting for the future.
Well, I'm glad.
Yeah, but only in about the last 2-3 years.
Yeah, that's right. Because currently we still live in a time where we're telling the software and the hardware what to do. But we are probably on the cusp of the opposite happening. So, Al, what a great career you've had, man. You've seen it all up to this point. I'm sure you'll still find it fascinating what changes even after you've moved on away from the automation industry. And Mike, you've got years ahead to see what all this AI is going to bring us, the promise and the detriment that may come from it. But like all technology, right, it's always going to move forward. Technology rarely takes a step backwards, and it moves forward at a faster and faster pace. So thank you guys again for joining us to talk about how hardware plays into that that role.
Absolutely. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks.
Well, Tom, I think that was great. It was great to hear from both of those guys. I mean, they know so much more about hardware than I do.
It did not disappoint. And it is a good topper for our latest series on data and moving to a more data centric environment, because hardware plays a part. Like you said earlier, before the show started, we focused on software up to this point. Today was a hardware conversation, and I'm glad we were able to close out the series this way.
Oh yeah, no, I totally agree. And I guess one of the things we didn't touch on extensively is kind of how, you know, when we talk about edge and cloud and how the hardware kind of plays that part to bring the data between networks and to the cloud and to different facilities and things like that. I think that's still something that would be cool to talk about that we haven't really touched on too much, but I'm really happy those guys agreed to come on and I think that was a great show.
I enjoyed every bit of it. And again, congratulations to Al Letourneau for his long career in the automation industry, specifically with Rockwell Automation. He is a legend in our workspace, and we wish him well.
Yeah, absolutely. I would like to mention before we end this that as we end this kind of mini series on digital transformation, we'd love to hear some ideas about what our listeners want to hear and what, you know, topics they'd like us to talk about in automation, in the industrial space. And honestly, no subject's too small or big. I'd like to hear what people are thinking.
Completely agree, Brian. And anybody that would like to share some ideas or thoughts or feedback, you can go to thinmanager.com/podcast and fill us in. Let us know what you'd like to hear, like to learn about.
The Plant Podcast is produced by the Thin Manager product team. Thin Manager is a Rockwell Automation technology. The opinions and statements made as part of this podcast are not necessarily those of Rockwell Automation. Listeners should not rely on or recommend any content as advice, guidance, or instruction. The Plant Podcast is strictly for the entertainment of our listeners.